Have you actually talked to Ken Hulick? Or?
I have. I have talked to Ken.
Okay, good.
Good morning, Bob. This is part five of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Robert Bob Cornelius, Cornelius. My name is Tom Martin. Today is June 5, 2018. It's Tuesday. And Bob, may we have your permission to record this telephone interview?
Yeah, you may, uh-huh.
Thank you very much. So in part four, last time you had recounted your recollections of Jack Fields and Lester Womack and Dave Strope. And the next person on the list is Ken Hulick, H-U-L-I-C-K. Did you have anything else you wanted to add about Dave?
Well, I did mention he was killed in a plane crash in Northern California. I don't recall, you know, how I found that out. It was probably through the employee alumni newsletter. We used to look at that. They always had an out of the traces and in memoriam sections there, and I think probably it was in there. And I don't recall in this plane flight he was killed on whether it was a Park Service flight or whether it was just a private flight. I tend to believe it was just a private flight he was on and killed in that way. I remember Dave as being very competent and you know, I didn't know a lot more about him other than the trip we took out to Cape Solitude. So,
well, thank you for that. Yeah, many people would like to know more about. How did you first meet Ken Hulick?
Ken was working on the South Rim during the winter fall period, I believe, and I would go around with some of the permanents to get experience, you know, at on night patrols and whatnot on my own time. Pardon me. And I went around with Ken quite a few times. And so that's kind of how I got to know him.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I knew of him my first summer because he was an Inner Canyon Ranger at Phantom. But the fact that he was at Phantom and I was on the South Rim, I don't remember if I ever actually met him or knew who he was. I might have seen him around the office or something. But you know, they would be on 10 and 4 schedules, so they'd be down the canyon for 10 days and out for 4 generally, so your chances of seeing somebody that was in her canyon were a little bit slim unless you actually went down there. Pardon me. And Ken, you know, it seemed like a very, he was, you know, I kind of looked up to him because he was a permanent ranger. He was very competent, and he seemed to know, and he'd been around a while. I remember he had been to the law enforcement training center, not Fletsy that's in Georgia, but he had been to what was called the Consolidated Law Enforcement Training Center in Washington, D.C., I believe.
Huh.
And we used to call that, it was CLETEC or something like that. We call it Syphilitic. I remember that was the rather than Fletsy. But anyway, he had been to that. And I remember one story he told that was interesting. He said he had been to this pre-Fletsy, and he had learned, you know, techniques with his baton. And he one evening confronted this large Navajo man that they had a lot of trouble with, and I believe he had some real quite a criminal history. He was a great big guy, and Ken said he confronted him by himself, and he thought, well, here's my opportunity. He told the guy he was under arrest for, I think, intoxication. I don't know if it was drunk driving or drunk in public, or, you know, whether he was doing some vandalism, or I don't know what the reason was. But he figured, well, he would try to arrest this guy, and the Navajo man said no, he wasn't going to be arrested. He didn't want to go to jail. And so Kin thought, well, this is an opportunity for me to use my baton, one of the techniques I've learned with my baton, where you kind of take the baton and kind of whirl it by your side and let the guy have it right in the solar plexus, and that, you know, doubles him over, and you can subdue him. And so he said he did this. He took a big swing at this guy and hit him right in the stomach, and the guy just went, ugh, and stood there. And Kin thought, uh-oh, you know, my life is flashing before my eyes. And fortunately, a couple other rangers showed up. I think it was like probably some of the guys that were working then, you know, could have been Womack, or there was a seasonal named John Glotis that was a big guy. Anyway, they surrounded this this guy, and then he agreed, well, okay, I'll go to jail, you know. And they took him to jail. But I always thought that was an interesting story, because even though you learn techniques in the classroom and that sort of thing, they don't always work in the field in real life, you know.
Yeah, and Kin was a stout, he probably stood 6 foot, didn't he?
Yeah, he was at least 6 foot or 6'1", somewhere in there, tall guy.
Yeah.
And another story he told me, this was from Phantom Ranch, and it involved Robert Kennedy. Have you ever heard this? Did he talk about this story?
He might have, but the more people that recount it, the more little spices we'll get about it, so...
Well, mine would just be hearsay, and from what I remember him telling me. But the Kennedys were always trying to let the public know that they were, you know, outdoorsy and sports-minded, and
mm-hmm.
vigorous and energetic and healthy and all these things, and they used the media. Like they were the first ones to really use television and stuff to get their political views out.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Kennedy came down the Colorado River on a raft trip and landed at Phantom Ranch. And Kin said, told me that he went down to the beach to represent the Park Service and greet the senator and to just be there for the group, see if they needed anything or anything on their trip down the river. And I guess Bobby Kennedy was terribly put out that the superintendent wasn't there and there wasn't a big entourage of Park Service people, and really gave Kin a really bad time, and, you know, even threatened his job and everything, you know. Of course, who knows how much alcohol and
sure.
that sort of thing might have played in this response of Senator Kennedy. I know in my experience with river running, I always refused to drink, because I thought, you know, I have a hard enough time, when I was a dinosaur, had a hard enough time running the rapids, stone sober. I didn't know what it would be like if I was drunk. So I never drank on the river, but I always remember, as you would leave the put-on points at Lador or at Deer Lodge Park or Echo Park or Rainbow Park, you didn't hear the sound of the water or the birds or the wind through the trees or all these wonderful natural things. You heard the hiss of the flip-tops as people popped their beer cans, you know. I mean, that seemed to be the mantra of running the river, was, having everybody drinking from the get-go, you know.
Interesting.
So that could have been the reason for Kennedy's outburst, who knows. But Other than that, I know there was a lot of drama on the South Rim, you know, with they had these baseball parties and all this, and I don't know how Ken was involved in all of that, but I know there were a lot of people that were involved in some real hanky panky up there.
Uh-huh.
But that was certainly a rumor, and he did after he left. Phantom moved up to the North Rim, as I recall, and then he went to Everglades. I actually visited him at Everglades, had dinner with him and stuff at Everglades, and I remember it was really nice down there in the I think it was March that I went to Everglades, and he he said I was really fortunate because the mosquitoes would just carry you away down there in the summer, you know.
Yeah.
And I had a real interesting thing happen. This is kind of non-related, but was at Everglades. We went out to one of the hammocks there on our auto tour, and I stopped at this hammock, and I saw these guys stripping these they were like air plants or something off of the trees and putting them in a bag, you know. So I went back to the visitor center and reported this, and a ranger was coming in from Homestead and stopped these guys and searched their car and found a whole trunk full of these air plants, you know.
Huh.
And I remember Ken that evening saying, well, that was the first case that they'd had down there, you know.
Wow.
Of someone stealing stuff, so it was kind of interesting from that standpoint.
Hmm.
You know, I don't remember when I moved to Phantom really talking a lot to Ken, maybe on occasion about things. You know, how he had done things down there as opposed to how I might be doing things.
I mean, was there a lot to it? Meaning, Ken would just basically say, there's your quarters over there, and have a good time. Or did he actually walk you around and say, here's the campground, you'll need to check people's permits, or here's the river you need to deal with?
No, I never met him at Phantom. We never spent any time at Phantom together.
Huh.
I just mean by, you know, by phone call or something like that. When the reorganization took place, he was gone up to the North Rim, and that became his interest. But I mean, as far as, you know, calling the guy that used to work there and finding out what had happened, how it was handled, I didn't do that with Ken, except maybe a little bit. And that was in part because there was a guy named Ron Lucas, who was a seasonal, and he had worked with Ken down there for at least one season. I don't know if he had worked for more, and so I was able to, you know, find out from him how the operation worked. So that was how that was done.
So Ron basically was the one who trained you up to the Phantom job.
Pretty much, yeah. He was my kind of on the job training person down there, and we worked together that whole first summer of 1970.
Was he older than you? Was he younger than you? What?
About the same age.
Okay.
We were both in our 20s. I was probably by that time, I would have been 20, 22, I guess, when I went. When I went down there for the second time. The way I got to Phantom was kind of interesting, and Ed Carlson played a role in that. And I'll just talk about one other story about Ed.
Please.
If we can move on to him.
Yeah.
You know, I told you about him wrapping his Ford Torino station wagon or whatever it was around the tree when he was having some issues. Well, he had another incident, and he was going through some really tough times at that point.
Hmm.
And he was married to a woman named Diane or Diana. And he had, I think he had four kids or something like that. They lived in one of the Mission 66 houses there in the village. And there was a lot of, like I was mentioning I said hanky-panky going on. There was a lot of stuff going on in the village. It was a lot of drama, and you never knew what story to believe, you know, from time to time. Ed, one time I talked to him, and he said he thought that a lot of the issues that went on the South Rim were a result of people coming from small parks into a big park, where the park they'd left, they might be very few people there. They got to a big park, it's more of almost an urban situation, and there were a lot more social opportunities, and people didn't use good common sense, you know, in some things. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyhow, we had this one evening, we got a report that Ed had threatened to, he was accusing one of the maintenance foremen, I think, of trying to break up his family and causing problems with his wife and et cetera, and it was really sounded like a really volatile situation. We were told, Jim Cutler and I, we were told to go up to Ed's house and get the kids out of the house.
Wow.
And so we went up there, and I'll never forget. Now this is the guy, you know, Ed's going to be my supervisor. He'd asked me if I wanted to go down to Phantom, and I had said sure. I'd like to go down there after I had hiked down and looked at the place. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But he Cutler went to the front door, and there was a big rock in the yard. He says, and Cutler had me hide behind that rock, and he went to the front door, and it was lighted, and he knocked on the door a couple times, and Ed came to the door, and instead of just opening the door normally, he grabbed the door and he flung it open really fast. It was flung into the inside, and Cutler jumped about 4 or 5 feet. I mean, because we knew Ed loved guns. We knew he had a lot of guns, and so here I am. I'm out hiding behind the rock with my pistol on him.
Wow.
And fortunately, you know, Ed didn't have any firearms with him or anything at the time. He didn't come to the door with anything, and. So Cutler talked to him for a little bit and found out that neither Diane or the kids were in the house. Ed was in there by himself, and everything was okay. And so we went ahead and left, you know. But I've always thought back to that moment. That could have been just an awful moment for the Park Service and for me, obviously, you know.
Sure, sure.
Have a shootout at my future boss's house.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know if Ed knew I was out there or not. I really don't, because of the lighting situation. I was kind of in the shadows, you know. So, but anyway, I was having some real questions in my mind of, you know, whether I wanted to work for this guy or not, you know.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, you know, he was going through a terrible time in his life.
The poor man.
He and his wife divorced shortly thereafter, you know, and I think she either I think the kids went with her wherever she ended up. I have no idea.
Wow.
And so it was a very volatile, you know, very, very volatile situation and a very volatile evening.
Yeah. Yeah.
But prior to that, Ed had asked me if I wanted to go down to Phantom, and I said, "Well, let me think about it." I said, "Let me hike down there." I hadn't been to Phantom Ranch. I'd been down to Plateau Point, and I'd been a couple other places in the canyon, but I hadn't actually been to Phantom Ranch because I didn't have the time. I was too busy. Seeing the whole Southwest, you know, I didn't go down there. So I hiked down, and I spent the night at Phantom, and it was like in the early spring, before the rush of campers and hikers and stuff.
This was 1971? Oh, sorry, 1970?
This was 1970.
Okay, spring of 1970.
Spring of 70.
Thank you.
Yeah, spring of 70. And you know, it was like idyllic down there. It was just beautiful. There were a few campers, you know, up in the campground, and it was quiet. I just hit it on a particular day. I remember going out to the mouth of the Bright Angel Creek, where it flowed into the Colorado River, and there's a big high bank, or there was a big high bank on the downstream side of the west side of the creek, and there were some big boulders there, and I sat down on a boulder, and it was in the late afternoon, and I could see the bugs in the air, you know, you could see them and I was watching the swallows. You could see the swallows open their mouths and gobble these bugs up, you know.
Wow.
Man, this is so cool, you know, and you're right here in the rivers flowing by and making all this racket with the rapid, you know, and just a beautiful place. And didn't take me very long to say, sure, I'd love to go down there, you know.
Huh.
And so there was this huge park reorganization where they went from an old system where you had a, you know, chief ranger and district rangers and all. They went to this park manager system. And Ed went from being the safety officer to being what was called the corridor unit manager. And during spring break, he went down to Phantom Ranch and spent 10 days down there working. And it was a very illuminating time, I think, for him there were no controls on the camping down at Phantom Ranch, Indian Gardens. Those were the only two camps where Cottonwood was closed because the North Kaibab Trail was closed at that time.
Because of the
but
pipeline?
Wait just one second.
Okay.
I got to let my little dog out here. So there were no controls on the Inner Canyon, so people just showed up. And one night,
hang on, hey Bob, hang on right there. When you say no controls, you mean no permits? People could just
there were no permits
hike
yeah.
down.
There were no permits on Phantom Ranch and overnight camping at Indian Gardens.
People could do
no
it.
No permits for
but
what's
they
that?
People could do it, but they just showed up.
You did. They just showed up.
Okay.
The permit system was strictly for the unimproved trails and other places in the canyon.
For,
and people did get permits for that all
for the back country, essentially.
Right, the back country other than the corridor.
Okay. I got another question for you right here.
Okay.
You mentioned that the North Kaibab was closed, and that was because
right. The North Kaibab Trail was closed at the first bridge across the creek, that was because they were still working on the Trans Canyon water line. They had put the water line in, and then they'd had this enormous flood, I think in 67, and they were having to repair sections and improve sections of trail to accommodate the water line. So it all related to the construction that was going on up in there. They didn't want visitors up there getting in their way as far as construction.
And so let me...
They were using dynamite and stuff like that.
Yeah, let me ask you a little bit about that. We probably want to come... You know what, let's make a note of that. At one point, I'm going to, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like you to recount what you remember about that construction that was happening at that time. But
okay.
let's go back, because you were saying that Ed was down there at Phantom.
He went down to Phantom during the spring break period, and I think probably at that time spring break was a little more condensed as far as when particularly students and stuff would arrive, and people would have off from school, and families could do a spring vacation or something like that.
Okay.
So I don't think it was quite as long a period as it is now, but he went down there. And one night at Phantom, there were 1,200 people.
Wow.
If you can imagine that, 1,200 people at Phantom Ranch. And they were camped apparently everywhere, on all the beaches, in the campground, along the trail. They were, it was just crazy. A lot of big Boy Scout groups. So this had a real effect on Ed. He looked at all this, all the trash, all the fire pits that were being built. They were still allowing, driftwood to be picked up and burned, and people were having fires, and it was just a real mess. And there was also no control over the length of stay. The length of stay down there was 14 days.
Okay.
And so you had some people that were staying 14 days, and then, if you didn't figure out they'd been there 14 days, they stayed another 14 days or another 2 or 3 days or whatever.
Uh-huh.
So it was really an unmanageable situation. And then the toilet facilities down there was no toilet in the campground. There was only this toilet near the ranger station, which at that time was out by the river. And it was just a kind of a chaotic situation. Of course, after spring break was over, things improved as far as the number of people, if that's, improved. And so it got a little bit better, but it didn't get good. That's for darn sure.
Hmm.
Now, I went down there starting in, I think, mid-June of 1970. And Ron Lucas was already working down there. And I got some instruction in horsemanship by Jack Watson. He went up, we went over saddling the horse and putting the harness on, saddling the horse, putting the bridle on, and all these things.
Had you rode a horse before? Was that your first experience with?
Yes, I had as a kid.
Okay.
I had ridden quite a little bit, but not for many years. You get rusty on stuff. So I still considered myself somewhat of a novice, And so they gave me this horse. His name was Hammer. He was probably the most gentle of the three horses that we used in the canyon. Hammer was an old gray, white in color. They call them grays. Kind of had a dappling to him, and they had scotched his mane, or they'd actually, meaning they had cut his, instead of having long hair
mm-hmm.
for a mane, he had just kind of a buzz cut. They call
uh-huh.
that scotching him, and then he had a they'd done the same to his tail, so he didn't have a lot of hair on his tail.
Oh.
So he was pretty round. He was like riding a barrel,
Huh.
But he'd been in the canyon for years, and he kind of had a sad demeanor to himself, and but he had gotten his name Hammer by one time when he was young. They were going to shoe him, and they had him in the farrier's blacksmith shop there.
Mm-hmm.
And they one way that they have to teach the horse to stand on three legs. So they had put a rope around one of his rear legs, and they pull it up and they tie it around the neck of the horse. So his leg is up, and it sort of teaches him how to stand on three legs. Well, they did this with the horse, and then I guess the farrier left for a little while to go home and grab a bite to eat or something for lunch. When he came back, Hammer had fallen over on the concrete floor and he had banged his head against trying to get up, and banged his head, and he had a big place, I think it was on his left, above his eye, where there wasn't much hair, and that's where he had banged his head on the floor of the blacksmith shop, and because he was pounding his head, they decided to name him Hammer.
Oh.
So that's how he got it. That's how he ended up getting his name. Anyway, I remember, you know, getting on the horse, and I had some saddlebags. I had a whole bunch of food in these saddlebags, even some frozen. I know I took some milk, a gallon of milk, and I didn't have a pack mule with me. And I had a bunch of other foodstuffs that were, you know, frozen. And here I go down into the canyon, and the trail went from the Park Service corrals, which were up in the residential area, down past and back of the old Babbitt store and the post office, and then went down past the Fred Harvey corrals and then over to the Bright Angel trailhead, and then, you know, down the trail I go. And even though I'd ridden horses, I'd never ridden anything in the canyon, obviously. I always remember the first stop. Hammer stopped, and my leg is dangling over the edge of the cliff, you know, my outside leg. So that was the first stop, and we were parallel to the trail. And it was a little unnerving, you know, because I'm looking into space on one side. So I remembered that the foreman had told me to turn the horse. You turn him and have him face the canyon. And then that way, you know, they see the danger. What's dangerous is if you turn the horse or the mule the opposite direction and they get spooked, they could back off the edge of the cliff.
Yeah.
So down the canyon we go, and the first thing we ended up was stopping at Mile and a Half House. And what we were instructed to do at the rest houses was they had a broom there. They had a bunch of gunny sacks, you usually had to re-sack trash there because the squirrels, the rock squirrels, would get in the trash and chew them open. And if the packer hadn't got down there in time to get the trash, it would be scattered all over. So there was a bit of looking for cans in the rocks and stuff like that, getting that all re-sacked up and neat. And then they had a broom to sweep the shelter out, and it was unbelievable how much sand was in the thing. I remember, it seemed like you swept and swept and swept. And then the other thing you did was to check the telephone. They had an emergency telephone. This emergency telephone system hooked to all of the phones down in the inner canyon. If one was left off the hook, it disabled the entire phone system. It was really a poor system. And you had phones at Mile and a Half, 3 Mile House, River House, down at Pipe Creek, Indian Gardens. You had two phones at Indian Gardens, one of the Rangers' quarters and one of the maintenance quarters. And then you had, and you may have had one in the pump house. I'm not sure. I'm guessing they did in the pump house also. And then you had one at the ranger station at Phantom and one at the maintenance building that was next door to the ranger station. You had one at the USGS house. And then you had an indoor and an outdoor phone at Phantom Ranch itself, and then you had a phone at Cottonwood Camp.
Was there a phone at Tip Off, or was there a phone at Tip Off?
And also there was one at Tip Off.
Okay.
There was one at Tip Off, that's correct. So if any one of those phones was left off the hook, it disabled the entire system.
Wow.
As often happened, people would steal the insulators. They had these turquoise insulators. And they would steal those, or they would just take rocks and throw them and break the insulators.
Okay.
And later on, one of my jobs was to replace glass insulators on the phone line. We had guys from Mountain Bell rode mules down into the canyon.
Uh-huh.
And
So the phone line's there.
House,
you're a mile and a half. Trying to clean up. You've
went
got
to 3 miles.
Frozen food in
What's
your
that?
Yeah. You got frozen food in your saddlebags.
Right.
And the day is slowly moving by.
That's right. That's really a problem for me, as I'll relay a little later on. But it went to a 3 mile house and did the same thing again. Cleaned up and made sure the phone was okay. And so then, as I'm going down the trail, I go down a little ways, and I'm on the Jacob's Ladder, heading down, and there's these two people there, and this woman is just absolutely wiped out. And I remember her saying to me, what I did is I said, they were so dehydrated, they were coming out of the canyon, that I put her on Hammer, and I walked her down to Indian Gardens, and her husband followed along, and we decided they needed to spend another night at Phantom. At Indian Gardens.
Sure.
Because they were so dehydrated, and I remember her saying, "Oh," she says, "when I saw you on that horse, I thought you were God." You know, not quite that.
Yeah.
Not quite that. Well, anyway, I got to Indian Gardens, and I made my first rescue, basically, of my time in the canyon. And we get a report that there's a woman down on the down below Indian Gardens at the Devil's Corkscrew down there.
Yep.
And she's been there, for laying across. She's laying in the trail. I didn't know what to think, so I Vic Wadahamaji was at Indian Gardens, and I asked Vic, I said, "Can I use your freezer and your refrigerator for my food?"
Oh,
so
good.
He put all my food in his refrigerator, and then I got on Hammer, and away we went. We went down to the partway down the Devil's Corkscrew. This is June, see. And it's like 110 degrees, I mean, down in the inner canyon there. It is really hot. So I come up upon this woman, and she's lying across the trail. And so I start, she's almost incoherent, but I'm talking to her a little bit. And I ask her, I said, "Well, how long have you been here?" And she said she'd been there for hours and hours. And that people had just been walking up the trail and just sort of stepping over and continuing on, and so I said, "Well, we've got to get you out of here." And then she mentioned something about being diabetic and not having her medication with her. So I thought, boy, we really got a problem now. So I got her. I had a canteen, and I soaked her down really good with a canteen, and then I was able to get her in up onto the horse, into the saddle, and I got her to hang on to the saddle horn, and I started leading Hammer back up toward Indian Gardens, and I would kind of glance over my shoulder, and every once in a while she'd start to slide out of the saddle, and I'd have to stop and run back and push her back up onto the saddle. And somehow we got her to, of course I was carrying her pack too, but we got her up to Indian Gardens and brought a helicopter down and flew her out, because she was really in bad shape. She wasn't in like a diabetic coma at this point, I don't think, but she was getting there. And so that was another incident that happened on my way down. So then I loaded all my supplies back up, and off I go again down toward Phantom. Well, late afternoon, I finally arrived at Phantom Ranch, and I remember going along the river trail and seeing Ron Lucas. It was late, getting toward evening. It was probably 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and he was walking the beaches there, and, we waved, and I went down, and he showed me where the where to put the saddle and everything in the tack room and all that stuff. And then I think it was the next next morning, we kind of toured around and looked at all the jobs that we had to do down there. And, you know, it was just, it wasn't quite the same as my idyllic little first trip down there. It was absolutely atrocious. I mean, they had trash cans in the campground. They had, I think they had like four trash cans in the campground. And they had this huge burner. It was about almost 6 foot tall and probably 3 foot in diameter. And it sat in the campground not too far from that the rock rest house down.
So it was
there.
it was like a big dumpster kind of thing.
It was a big it was a burner where it had ventilation holes around it, and it was designed to burn trash.
Okay.
And what we would do is.
And where? Sorry, I'm going to jump in again. Where was its location?
It was near. There's a big cotton. There used to be a big cottonwood tree, and there's this lean-to rock rest house just as you on the lower end of the campground.
Okay.
And it was right in that vicinity.
Okay. So there's a cliff there. There's a cliff there. This is on Creek Wright of Bright Angel Creek. There's a cliff there, and then there's a little rock house kind of structure
right.
there. Okay.
Yeah. It was maybe 100 feet from that.
Okay.
Upstream. And so we would put trash in there that was a burnable, and we'd make a mixture of gasoline and diesel, and we'd soak this stuff, and then you would light it off, and there'd be this big whoomph, you know, and the smoke was just horrible. It'd be black smoke rolling up, you know.
Wow.
and the stench was just really bad. But we had to, you know, reduce the trash down so it was we could get it out of there, and so there was that to deal with. That was the first thing. Then there were the restrooms, and the restrooms, the recovery on, you know, a toilet takes a little bit of time. Well, the toilets were being used so quickly that they would get plugged pretty regularly.
Wow.
So you would have standing water and human waste and other debris and, you know, in the floor in there, and you'd have to deal with that and finally get the toilet working again. And in some cases it was better to go stand out there if there were a lot of people in the area and be like traffic cop, you know, and say, instead of having a men's and a women's, you would send the men over to the women's and so on and so forth.
Uh-huh.
There were always more men than women anyway. And so there was that to deal with. And then there was the pool house. And at that time, Fred Harvey had activated the pool. And by this time, it was a sort of a traditional concrete type pool, not the old rock, beautiful rock pool that they originally had there.
Yes.
And they were having trouble with the health department at some point, but when I got there, the pool was active, and they were using it. The problem they were having is they were having all these hikers. It was supposed to be for the guests of the ranch.
Oh.
But everybody with all their dirt on them and everything were jumping in the pool and getting it all nasty, and
oh,
they
wow.
couldn't keep it clean. But that was not my problem. The pool was not my problem. My problem was they had a couple of trash cans there at the bathhouse, and we were responsible for the trash. So we were getting all of Phantom Ranch's trash there, and we had to sack it up, and we'd carry it back down to the ranger station. It was mostly aluminum cans and you know, papers and stuff like that. And then also the bathroom there, men's and women's bathroom, and a shower. And the showers were leaking, and it was flooding the whole, both bathrooms.
Oh, wow.
So you would go up there with a squeegee and try to get the water out of there so people didn't have to wade in to go to the bathroom. It was just really bad.
So were you doing maintenance as well? If there was a leaking faucet or a fitting or something that needed replacement, was that something that you would take care of, or would you call maintenance for that?
No, you'd pretty much have to take care of it, you know, up to your
ability,
level of expertise.
Yep.
You know, I think, I used to call myself a manger, you know, because you did so much maintenance down there, and especially initially when I went down there. So then we went to the next thing was, I remember my boss, Ed Carlson, he sent some new shower heads down, and we were able to get the thing to stop leaking. But I think in this case, maybe they might have eventually had to send a plumber down because there was there was something internal inside the wall. And so we had to, or they had to replace the valves or something. So I think they might have sent a maintenance man down to repair that. But it took a few weeks to do it.
Okay.
And get somebody down there. So then we went down to the boat beach, and this was really where the biggest problem was. And the boaters would come in, and there was kind of a little fenced area there. They had a little sort of a temporary fence around, and probably 6x6 or something like that. And then there was another burner. We had another burner down there on the beach. And the boaters would come in, and instead of leaving their gunny sacks full of trash, like they were actually supposed to do by permit, that
mm-hmm.
was the way they were supposed to handle the trash at that time, they would dump the trash.
Oh, and keep the
gunny sacks.
Keep the sacks, huh?
And so we would end up with this enormous pile of trash, and we would have to resack it. Now, and into gunny sacks, and then we would pile it under a mesquite tree. And the guy that was doing the most of that was Vic Guadahamaji. He was the maintenance guy, and he was the relief guy, and he would come down, and we would help Vic, or if, because we only had, because of the scheduling and the number of people we only had like 2 days to work together, and we'd try to get more of the heavy maintenance done at that time.
Uh-huh.
And Ron and I also went down and that first day, that was one of the things we did, you know, as
wow.
orientation was we sacked trash.
So you
we
would
couldn't keep up with it.
You would burn what you could. You would burn what you could burn, and what you couldn't burn, you would put into gunny sacks and then send out on mules.
Right.
Okay.
Right. It would go out on mules. And it was awful because you had broken glass.
Oh.
You had, cans that had been opened. You were always getting cut and stuff like that. And it was really just a horrible, horrible job.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, I was able to deal with it. And I one of the things that surprised me, you know, I have this log, this old log that I kept while I was down there, and I was reading, and Warren Hill, who was the river manager, and several other managers from up on the rim came down to Phantom and were looking at the operation down there and how these guys in their right minds could look at this boat beach and think that everything was copacetic is beyond me.
Wow.
The only thing I can think of is whenever the Park Service is great for this, when they have these management teams that would go around and they would do evaluations of park operations. And the only thing I can think of is when Warren and these guys came down there, we had been, whoever was down there had been told in advance and had been instructed, be sure you get everything cleaned up down there.
Oh.
We want it to look really good. And that's the way those management teams always work, is that the park manager wants to look good, so he says, you know, be sure you get this cleaned up and that taken care of and this taken care of, because they knew there were problems and they didn't want to get caught with the problem. They wanted it to look like everything was going good.
That's
and
a difficult
really,
way to manage things.
It was an awful way to manage things.
Gosh.
And so that's the way, that's what was going on, I think, at Phantom, at least in this case. Because, like I say, I don't believe these guys could have come down and seen the situation as it was that I was dealing with, and really, in their right minds, have thought things were okay. So what I did, the boat beach was an interesting thing. I called up to the South Rim, and I talked to Warren Hill. And I said, could you send me a copy of the boat permit down? I want to look at it. I didn't have a copy of it. And they did that. And I read it over. And there was a provision in there where the boaters could leave their trash at Phantom Ranch, but it had to be sacked. They couldn't do this dumping stuff. I don't know how that ever got started. But sometimes things get started, and if as turnover of personnel and so on and so forth, you know, it just gets to be done a certain way. So I read this, and so I called up Warren Hill, and I said, Warren, I said, are you aware of this, you know, this trash problem at Phantom? And I don't remember what he said, but I told him, I said, we are going to clean it up here, and these boaters are going to start leaving their trash in gunny sacks, or I'm going to start writing tickets.
Okay.
And he said, oh, don't do that.
Oh.
You know, oh, don't do that, you know. And I said, well, we are not going to be up to our armpits and maggots anymore down here. I said, this is disgusting. And so Ron Lucas and I and Vic, we spent about a week, I guess, and we cleaned the boat beach up. We made a screen, out of 2x4s with a screen on the bottom, and we screened the sand. We got all the glass and the pop tops and everything, cigarette butts and everything out of the sand. And we cleaned that all up. We burned everything that we could. We sacked everything up, and we took the little fence that they had there, we threw that away. We took the burner, we threw that away, and now we have a clean beach. And so, what happens? Well, here comes the boaters in, and the first guy comes up and empties a bag right where the trash used to be,
right
where it used to be left. And so I went down, and I wrote him a ticket for littering. And, wow, was he upset. But, you know, that was okay. I said, you know, we're not, you know, read your permit. And so to give credit to management, they backed me up on that.
Okay.
And
good.
And even the second person that I ended up citing was a boatman for Martin Litton, and that really hit the fan, because Martin Litton was a lawyer in addition to having Grand Canyon dories, and he wrote a 5-page letter to the Park Service complaining about it. What they actually did, they didn't leave their trash on the beach. They hauled their trash up to Phantom Ranch and filled up all of the trash cans up at Phantom Ranch, and the concession was PO'd about it. So I wrote them a ticket, and so the park stuck by their guns, and they backed me up on this trash deal. And you know, I don't know how it happened, but I only wrote the two tickets, and it was like a the underground telegraph or something, you know, swept through the boating community, and we didn't have any other problems with trash from boaters. They started carrying their trash through the canyon or leaving it sacked under the mesquite tree there at Phantom. And
I think I looked into that, and the Park Service was providing the gunny sacks at Lee's Ferry, but they would all get full by the time the boaters got to Phantom, so they were dumping the trash on the ground and then refilling the sacks. And eventually the Park Service said, we're not going to provide the sacks, and you've got to carry it out. So it took a while, but this is great as a step along the way to kind of get that detail sorted out.
Oh, it was, you know, and I know, I think if Victor Wanahamaji ever smiled, it was after he found out he didn't have to go down there and sack that trash up. We would get up at like 4 o'clock in the morning and go down there.
Wow.
While it was still cool, you know, in the summer heat. You couldn't work past about 10 on that type of work and survive, you know. And then the other thing that happened was the Fred Harvey had to close the pool because they were having trouble keeping the pool clean, and then they closed. I think they closed the restrooms too, and we quit taking care of any trash at Phantom Ranch. So now we're down to just the trash in the campground and the burner, and of course Ed Carlson had been down there and seen the 1,200 people in the area. And so he came up with the idea of this Inner Canyon permit system. And what it was this took some selling, I'm sure, on his part. And it was a tag, a yellow a paper or a composite-type tag, and it had the rules, basic rules, you know, no fires, pack out your trash, all those types of things.
Uh-huh.
On one side. And on the other side, it had what campgrounds you were going to be staying at in the canyon. And it had a little wire on it, and you could wire it to your pack. That's what we had the people do.
Okay.
And but one step in this was, there were two steps. One was to stop having trash cans and burners in the campground. And I thought, boy, this, you know, will this really work? You know, because people, they still have the trash. Are they really going to carry it out? And we were a little hesitant to do it, but it was obvious that we had to do something because we were just overwhelmed with trash.
Yeah.
And then I came up with this idea. I said, well, let's stencil the tables. We'll put a stencil on the tables, and it'll say, you packed it in, you pack it out.
Oh, cool.
And so Ed thought that was a good idea. So we stenciled all the tables. Well, someone from the South Rim, I remember, came down and saw those stencils on the tables and thought, oh, gee, you know, that's really kind of offensive, you know, to people, to that type of wording. So we said, well, come up with something better, you know.
Uh-huh.
No one could, so we stuck with that, at least for the time being. And really, when we got rid of the trash cans, things improved. You got more questions about what do we do with the trash, you know. We'd say, pack it out, you know. But
Bob, I'm going to jump in and stop right here because, you know, I'm a generation or so, you know, I'm a little younger than you, but the concept of pack it in, pack it out has, you know, always been drilled into my brain. Did you come up with that? You pack it in, you pack it out. Did you come up with that phrase?
Yeah.
That's brilliant. Well done. You're a marketing genius. Because it's a simple,
well,
you know, pack it in, pack it out is just great.
Yeah. The other thing we came up with down there that Ed came up with this is he had a trash compactor. He said, let's, he had a kitchen trash compactor, I guess, in his house.
Hmm.
And one day he thought, hey, you know, we could, maybe we could use this for Phantom. So he said, I came over to his house one day and we compacted some trash and we took the compacted trash bag and we put it in a gunny sack.
Okay.
And it fit just perfect.
Huh.
And so we figured we could get two compacted bags of trash into one gunny sack.
Huh.
And so now we had a way of, you know, you still had trash down there, whether the pack it in, pack it out was supposed to work perfectly, but it doesn't, obviously. And so you still end up with trash, and you end up with domestic trash that the Rangers are generating,
right,
and other, you know, maintenance guys and everything. So you're still going to have trash. And so this was a good solution. So he bought a little compactor, and we put it down in a little shed down between the corral and the ranger station down there. And then we would compact the trash and then put it in the sack. So we needed another way to deal with the trash. When I first got down there, I'll never forget, the maintenance guys would put the trash bags, well, not the maintenance guys, we would too. We would stack them right in front of the ranger station. And there was this big pile of gunny sacks of rotting trash.
Oh gosh!
You'd turn on your swamp cooler, and all you could smell was garbage. You know, and I thought, I don't like this very much. And that went on for a while, and then there were a couple of big culverts, kind of oblong culverts with metal lids welded on top of them, and they were supposed to be valve boxes for the Trans Canyon water line.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So there were a couple of them left over, and so I came up with this idea. There were actually three of them, that I would go down between the corral and the ranger station, and I dug this big pit, and I put these things down in there, and then you could lift the lid up and put the gunny sacks down in these, and that there was no smell or anything then.
Made sense.
And so the other thing we did is we put a hitch rail there so that the packer could come
uh-huh.
there to where those lidded boxes were, lift them up, and then he could load the trash from there, and then we didn't have trash in front of the ranger station and the maintenance building anymore. And so that helped with here I'd gone, I thought I was a park ranger, but I was actually a solid waste management disposal expert, you know.
I love that term, manger.
But it really was true.
Bob, I'm going to ask you another question here. You mentioned the yellow tags with
yes,
the regulations on it and the campground location. I am assuming that also came with a restriction on the number of campers allowed to be in the corridor per day.
That's correct.
Okay.
And
that was 1970 or 71?
Let me think. Was probably 71.
Okay.
I'm thinking, because the first year was pretty rough, as I recall. I know we didn't get to it that first summer. It was the following 71, it would have been, is when they instituted that. And they started it out by, when Easter arrived, they had a publicity blitz,
Oh.
especially in some metropolitan areas, and there was a lottery. They had a lottery, and they drew names for the number of people that were going to. I think the capacity at Bright Angel was like 80 people or something like that.
Okay.
And we came up with, looking at the campground, which was at that time only on the west side of the creek, and figuring we could put 80 people or so many groups in there. So they had this lottery, and people's names were drawn from all over the country, and then they went ahead and issued the permits when people got to the canyon based on their place in the lottery. And so that's how it kind of got started. And then from then on, we didn't have lotteries after that, as I recall. We just people, if they showed up, they got permits and went on their way. And if they couldn't go down into the corridor, they might be suggested to go down to Hermits or Horseshoe Mesa or something like that. And so we now had a con oh, the other thing we did is instead of having a 14-day limit at Phantom and at Indian Gardens, we had a two-night limit. And that really helped, and it stopped the long-term camping, which was a large part of our problem.
Okay.
What would happen is some guy would come down. Usually I'd see him hitchhiking on Highway 66 when I was going to Flagstaff, and then I'd come back and they'd be in my campground and they'd stay there for 2 weeks, see? And then you'd go out on your 4 days off, you'd come back and you couldn't remember if that guy was there for 2 weeks or 2 days, and you'd get some of them that would stay there for a long time, and as people would leave, they'd give this guy all of their canned
Oh,
goods and
and
all of and
yeah,
this and
take
that,
all
and
their
pretty
food.
soon,
Sure.
yeah, he'd have this huge store of food and stuff there, and then all of a sudden one day he's gone, and guess who gets to clean everything up?
Pile of junk there,
So
yeah. Huh.
yeah, it was unbelievable, and this had gone on for years, I guess, down there, and so the two-night limit really and the permits really stopped all that,
Excellent.
and things became much more manageable, and
Great.
at least was a temporary compared to what they have now. I think the backcountry permit office didn't come into effect until much later on. They were doing everything like at the visitor center and originally at the South Rim District Ranger office and then the visitor center. And
Okay.
I don't know if there was ever a time where they issued permits at both locations, but I
I've
think
got
it
a,
was either or.
sorry, I've got another question I wanted to ask about kind of go back a little bit. You mentioned that there was a woman with a diabetic problem down in the Devil's Corkscrew, and he had gotten her back to
Right.
Indian Gardens, and she had diabetic issues, and he actually got a helicopter in to take her out. Were the helicopters, did the park have its own helicopter by that time, or were they still using the helicopters from the Trans Canyon pipeline work? Do you remember
They
that? Were you clear on that?
had a contracted helicopter. It was a Jet Ranger, and it probably was used on the for things along the Trans Canyon waterline too, I'm
Okay.
guessing, maybe taking personnel in and stuff like that, or sling loading things occasionally, but I do know it was contracted to the Park Service. If we had an emergency, I think we probably got priority. I
Okay.
remember it was only like $80 or $180, I think, per hour or something like that. It
Okay.
wasn't anything like it is today as far as cost, but
Sure.
we used helicopters a lot for search and rescue and to haul people out of there for all different kinds of reasons. I remember even boatmen coming to me and just begging me to get someone helicoptered out of the canyon because they were like a mental case, or something.
Ah.
And we had a lot of injuries that came off of the river that had to be helicoptered out.
Okay.
And then, you know, a lot of heat emergencies, and surprisingly, quite a few people with diabetic emergencies. That seemed to be one where they'd go off and forget their medication, or the fact that they were in a really harsh environment would somehow trigger a problem. And so
okay.
we had different you know, glucose and stuff like that we could give people, or you know, the old stand-in orange juice and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That we'd use.
Well, I would like to ask you more about the medical situation that you encountered at the time. I'd also like to ask you more about kind of the river, what was happening there, and about Duke, the Tennessee Walking Horse. But
mm-hmm.
I've got a meeting I need to run away to here now. So if it's okay with you, let's wrap today's interview up, and we will pick this up again for part 6.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, give me a minute here, and this has been, this is the conclusion of part 5, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Bob Cornelius. Today is the 5th of June, 2018, and thank you so much, Bob. Hang on for a second.